Hello, this is the Angry GM. I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to fit this in today, considering I'm a day late on even posting this. And also, this isn't going to be live, despite what I said about doing these things live on a regular schedule. That just hasn't quite happened yet. I'm still recovering from complications that arose last week due to my ongoing chronic health conditions, blah, blah, blah. Poor me. Doesn't matter. I have an article to get out and therefore an article to read aloud. And I do want to make sure that I'm at least getting proofread alouds out, even if I can't get them out with the article themselves, and even if I can't read them, even if I can't record them live. So you're getting a proofread aloud of today's article, which is entitled, and I'm about to start now proofreading aloud, Professor Angry's Office Hours, How Players Play. Man, that title's a mouthful, but I established that these sidebars from the True Game Mastery lessons are called Professor Angry's Office Hours, so now that is what they are called. And interestingly enough, as a side note, this is a response to a lot of the shit I got from the last one, Problematic Actions, dealing with Problematic Actions or something like that, which was in itself a response to a lot of shit I got from stuff I said about how players take actions. So now here we are, dealing with the same crap again for important reasons. Put your books and syllabusy away, kids. Don't worry about taking notes. Forget about your homework. Let's talk. Yeah, this is the right place. This is the True Game Mastery Lecture Hall. I know I'm acting weird. I didn't even call you dumbasses or anything. Calm down. I'm not dying and your mom and I aren't getting a divorce. It's just that I've been reading the feedback I've been getting and lurking in your out-of-class discussions, and I'm kind of worried about jumping into the next couple of lessons. The ones about resolving sneaky infiltration and resolving social interaction. I think some of you are in for a struggle, and that's because you're still struggling with some things I said months ago. Or because you're just refusing to accept things I said as true. And because of that, I don't think you've got a good grasp on the relationship between players, player characters, game masters, non-player characters, role-playing, and game mechanics. I blame myself. I should have done a whole thing about non-player characters. Not on how to make good ones or portray them right, but on how they work, how you run them at the table. Infiltration and interaction rely heavily on the interplay between the player characters and any non-player characters in the scene. So we've got to get this right, and by right I mean R-I-G-H-T and not W-R-I-T-E, which is what I wrote. By wrote I mean W-R-O-T-E and not R-O-T-E, which is how I write things, by wrote. Anyway, moving on. For the next two class sessions, the second of which I'll post in under a week, I'm zooming out to the 30,000-foot perspective to talk again about this whole game mastering thing. I'm going to use that perspective to help you grok the relationship between true game masters and their NPCs. And because that relationship's almost exactly the opposite one the players have with their characters, I want to dig into that relationship first. Because some of you are still fighting me on that shit. If you can't accept and understand what I tell you in these next two lessons, you can't run any encounter with NPCs at all. Oh, wait, let me try that again, because I read the wrong words, but the words are right. If you can accept and understand what I tell you in these next two lessons, you can run any encounter with NPCs at all. If you can't, you can't. That's the game plan. Let's get to it. Zooming out. It's only a game. Long ago, I told you that role-playing games are, in fact, games. And lots of you still don't like that, or you refuse to accept it, or you reject the ramifications thereof. This here represents the last time I'm trying to get this through your skull. If after today you still claim that role-playing games are anything but games, or that they can be anything to anyone, you need another mentor, Nothing I can teach you will do you any good. You're a game master. You're running a game. And that means things. Goals, rules, and obstacles. Let's review this shit quickly. I've already said it more times than I want to. Games have goals. The players must be trying to achieve something. Something in the game. There must be a finish line. Something that signifies victory, or at least progress. In the case of tabletop role-playing games, the goals come not from the game's rule system, but from the specific adventures, quests, scenarios, modules, campaigns, or whatevers. Motivations aren't goals. Playing to have fun isn't a goal. It's a thing that happens while you pursue the goal. Games have rules. The rules establish how the players interact with the game. In the case of tabletop role-playing games, the game master is part of the rules. The GM's judgment calls and declarations are all part of the rules. As much a part of the rules as anything written in any book. You, the game master, are a game mechanic. You're part of the game. Games have obstacles. The players have to overcome things to win. These are true statements. If you disagree with them, you're not a true game master, and you never will be. Tests of strategy. Games challenge players to act within the rules to overcome obstacles and thereby achieve goals. Games thus test their players. Different games test different abilities. Sports test physical abilities. Video games test lots of different abilities, but many test manual dexterity and reaction time, along with any other abilities they test. Role-playing games can't test physical abilities by their nature. They only test mental abilities like resource management, problem-solving, deductive reasoning, and social interaction skills. Games that test player abilities allow players to affect the outcome and reward players for building their skills through play. Players who struggle with certain abilities will find games that test those abilities more challenging. But players will also strengthen their abilities over time and through play. Some games will be inaccessible to players who are lacking in the appropriate abilities and who have no interest in improving or testing those abilities. This isn't gatekeeping, this is life. Noodle-armed weaklings who don't care to build their muscles and hate getting sweaty won't like wrestling. That's not wrestling's fault. It's not the weakling's fault. It's no one's fault. There's no injustice. No one has been wronged. It's just a fact of life. Wrestling ain't for noodle-armed weaklings who don't care to get stronger and hate getting sweaty. At their most basic, role-playing games test strategic problem-solving, deductive reasoning, social interaction, resource management, and teamwork. Your job as game master is to test your players' abilities in those areas, and also many others that vary from game to game and system to system. These are factually true statements. And this is a sidebar I call on accommodating players. Everyone is born with different abilities and everyone faces different obstacles. That's beautiful and it's tragic. As a result, some people find it extremely difficult to engage in activities that others can easily. Making accommodations for such folks is the kind, human thing to do, and I would never ever say otherwise. But it is also delusional to claim such accommodations don't come with a cost. They always do. And so, every accommodation must be balanced against the negative impact it might have on the activity for the others enjoying it. That's an exceedingly complex balancing act, and it must be handled on a case-by-case basis by every individual who faces it. It is up to every game designer and game master in every group to decide what accommodations they will make for whom and what costs and sacrifices they're willing to make. Because every human being gets to decide for themselves what costs and sacrifices they're willing to make in their leisure time. I write for the general case and assume individual designers, game masters, and groups will decide how to accommodate those they wish to include. That's the choice I've made. There are reasons for that, and they don't matter. These are also facts. Simulated expertise. Role-playing games promise players the chance to experience adventures as someone else and to take on challenges unlike those the players face in their real lives. And that makes designing and running such games really tricky. Role-playing games must present experiences such that non-expert players can learn and master them, and which feel sufficiently like the experience in question to give the players the illusion of being an expert. Take combat, for instance. Most players have never held a sword, let alone used it to fight off a warband of marauding orc savages. If you want the best damned role-playing experience you can get that'll really make you feel like a warrior, you just need to spend a few years mastering swordplay and then battle other similarly trained swordsmen dressed as orcs. That'd do it, but that's a big ask. Games use a lot of tricks to dumb down the sword fighting experience, as it were, to let players feel like sword fighters without actually spending years of training. One common abstraction in video games is the choice between a light attack, a quick low damage attack that's hard to interrupt but won't penetrate any serious defense, and a heavy attack, a slow high damage attack that powers through enemy defenses but is prone to disruption. That's an approachable choice, and players can learn the best situations for each attack, learn to read opponents and recognize the proper openings for each, and so on. Thus, they're making choices like the choices sword fighters make, but they're not actual sword fighters, and there's plenty of room for strategic and tactical thinking. Such abstractions are compromises. They're trade-offs. They're replacing an experience with mechanics in the hopes of getting close enough. Game designers must do everything in their power to minimize those compromises and abstractions, lest the game they're designing feel nothing like the experience it represents, or lest they remove the player's power to make strategic and tactical decisions. Which is worse? That stuff? All true. Suck it up. Unpredictable outcomes. Games' outcomes are unpredictable. They're not wholly unpredictable, they're not completely and totally random, but they are not set in stone. You can't know how a game turns out until you play the final turn or roll the final roll or whatever. Tabletop role-playing games rely on random chance, unintended consequences, and incomplete information to keep players guessing about the outcome. I'm going to add a sentence. The key phrase there being players. You, the game master, are not a player. You don't get to be surprised. You're part of the game's mechanics. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I like that. The key phrase there being players. You, the game master, are not a player. You don't get to be surprised. You're part of the game mechanics. Sorry. You don't always get to be surprised. Often game masters are surprised, but you don't always get to be surprised. You're part of the game mechanics. Sorry. You can't prioritize your own surprise. Anyway, obviously, that random chance thing is why we have all those dice. But dice aren't the most important element here. They're the least. Unintended consequences arise from the game master evolving the world in response to the player's actions. To the player's actions. The game master is the perfect game mechanic for this because the human brain is so good at inventing logical, or at least reasonable, outcomes given just about any situation, no matter how ridiculous. Incomplete information relies on the fact that players only know as much as their characters can perceive, and they don't know it with perfect accuracy. As a GM, you can hide anything and everything the players shouldn't know, and you can translate perfectly quantified mechanical statistics into prose narration. Random chance, unintended consequences, and incomplete information are vital game mastering tools. That's also a fact. Why play games? That needs a question mark. Take everything I said above and file it under the definition of games. They are true of all games, except the things I said are true only of role-playing games specifically, or the stuff I said is generally or usually true or whatever. Use your reading comprehension skills for fuck's sake before you pick a fight with me. They're true of all games, and if there is a thing about which they are not true, that thing is not a game. The thing might be fun, it might be a fun activity, it might be totally worth doing, you might like it more than you like games, but it isn't a game. And I'm teaching people about role-playing games here. Games are distinct from hobbies, activities, puzzles, diversions, and all other interactive and non-interactive pursuits you might pursue. Why are they distinct? How are they distinct? That's hard to answer. It's down to psychology, and the jury is still out. Many motivational models. Psychologists know that people have unique psychological responses to games. They engage with games differently from other activities. And most people, and many social animals, seek out gameplay experiences. We're wired to play games just like we're wired to tell stories. Psychologists also know that while there are common responses to gameplay in all human brains, specific individuals seek specific kinds of games, and some games satisfy some people more than others. And there have been numerous attempts to break this shit down into categories to help designers build better games and to help marketers label games so people can more easily find the games they're most likely to enjoy. The Mechanics, Dynamics, Aesthetics Model. My favorite breakdown of gamer motivations comes from a 2004 paper called MDA, A Formal Approach to Game Design and Game Research by Robert Hanicki, Mark LeBlanc, and Robert Zubek. And apologies to any of those who I mispronounced. Hanicki. It's probably Hanicki. Robin Hanicki, Mark LeBlanc, and Robert Zubek. It lists 8 broad motivations that drive most gamers' engagements: sensation, fantasy, narrative challenge, fellowship, discovery, expression, and submission. But there's a lot more to the paper than that list, and I highly recommend giving it a read. It's not that long. The Quantic Foundry Gamer Motivation Model. Market research firm Quantic Foundry made their own gamer motivation model, and they've published it along with a bunch of tools for game designers and gamers on their website. I really like their model, too. Though I should say models, plural, as they've got 2. One for video gamers and one for board gamers. I personally find the video game model more closely translates to role-playing gamers. Their model also provides a list of common gamer motivations. They've got 6 major motivations, and they've got 6 major motivations, and each is divided into 2 sub-motivations. Action includes excitement and destruction. Social includes competition and community. Mastery includes challenge and strategy. Achievement includes completion and power. Immersion includes fantasy and story, and creativity includes design and discovery. And yes, there's a lot of overlap between their model and the MDA model. The Quantic Foundry website is a ton of fun to explore. You can get a gamer motivation profile, get game recommendations, and take a deep dive into their research and data gathering methodology. Check it out. Confusing what and why. I love and hate sharing this gamer motivation shit. I love it because it's fascinating to me. but I hate it because game masters always misuse it. And that often stems from confusing motivation with definition. Games have goals, rules, and obstacles. They test players. They have unpredictable outcomes. That's a definition, a minimal one. That's what a game is. The models I shared are built by psychologists and marketers trying to figure out why people like games so much and why people choose some games over others. If a thing doesn't test a player's abilities to overcome obstacles and achieve goals, it ain't a game. Games challenge players, but that's distinct from the challenge motivation described in the MDA and Quantic Foundry models. All games challenge players. Some players love games for their challenges. Some players love being challenged for other reasons, and some players are only into being challenged so much. And that brings me to another way people always misuse this shit. Missing the forest for the trees. Mix goals, rules, tests, and unpredictability together, and you've got a game, assuming you do it right. That game has the potential to satisfy a bunch of different motivations. To some degree, every game can satisfy every motivation spelled out in your model of choice. Every game provides a challenge. Every game tells a story. Every game has something to discover, and so on. Some games are really lacking in certain motivational elements, though. Solo games, for example, don't provide much of a social payoff, but they do actually provide a tiny little trickling bit, believe it or not, because of how humans see themselves in relation to communities and shared experiences. My point is that every game does something for every motivation. Every game just blends them up differently. Hardcore single-player action games provide satisfying challenges, but almost no fellowship, in addition to providing immersion and narrative and all that other crap. And every game offers the chance to express yourself, even if just by choosing one action or strategy over another. And that's good because every gamer is, to some extent, after every motivation. No one's looking for pure experiences. If they are, they shouldn't be playing games. Pure narrative experiences are better found in movies and books. Pure expression experiences are better found in learning how to draw or write. Pure social interaction is best found over a cup of coffee or a cocktail with friends. Motivations are ingredients, and games are cakes. There are lots of ways to make a cake, and lots of varieties of cake, and lots of cake preferences too, but you can't distill a cake down to just sweetness, or just fluffiness, or just prettiness, and still have a cake. Part of what defines the cake eating experience is eating something that's sweet and fluffy and pretty to look at, even if you like the sweetness the best. Any perspective that boils role-playing games down to just one aspect of gamer motivation is total horseshit. The GNS model? Horseshit. Saying players are either gamists, narrativists, or simulationists is the equivalent of saying that people eat cake for either sweetness, fluffiness, or prettiness, and each would be happier with raw sugar, soap foam, or pastel-colored plastic flowers. And the same is true of idiots who say role-playing games are collaborative storytelling experiences, or exist purely so players can express themselves or immerse themselves in a world. That's more raw sugar and plastic flower bullshit. But don't sweat it. Fortunately, all this gamer motivation is just that. Fortunately, all this gamer motivation crap is just that. It's crap. You don't need to sweat it. It really doesn't help designers as much as it helps psychologists and marketers. It's an attempt to understand quantifiably why games work and why some games work better for some people. Most of the best game designers just build games for people to play, and they get better at building games by building games. Obsessing over this shit just gets in your way. But that gamer motivation crap and that true and correct definition of all games ever is why I just got distracted because the downstairs dog just started barking its head off again. But that gamer motivation crap and that true and correct definition of all games ever is why I told you months ago something lots of you didn't want to hear or believe, apparently. It's why I said, players choose, characters act. I induced a lot of strokes when I said that players choose while characters act months ago. And then more when I explained the ramifications thereof. But I promise you, it follows from everything I said above. If you accept that games are what they are and gamers seek them for the synthesis of motivations described in those various models, then the best way to run a great game for as many players as possible is to follow the rule that players choose and characters act. I need you to both get this and accept it, or else you're going to have a stroke when I tell you that NPCs work exactly the opposite way. And you need to get that and accept it if you ever want to use an NPC for anything more complicated than a fight scene. Players choose. Players must choose their character's actions, and the driving forces behind those choices are way more complicated than you think. In general, five forces influence, or should influence, every player's action choices: in-game goals, character personality, player motivations, character abilities, and social dynamics. In-game goals. All else being equal, players choose actions for their players choose actions for their actions is what I wrote. I heard you like actions, so I put some actions in your actions so you can have more actions. All else being equal, players choose actions for their characters to maximize the odds they'll accomplish whatever in-game goals they're pursuing. That's why goals are such an important piece of the game design puzzle. If the players have nothing to shoot for, they're missing a key motivation for choosing actions. Character personality. Role-playing is about projecting yourself into a role. It's imagining yourself as someone else and trying to act as that person or thing. Part of every choice is reflecting the personality, motivations, hopes, and fears of your in-game persona. Player motivations. Players game for reasons, and they're driven to satisfy their wants, needs, and desires as they play games. Explorers will explore. Challengers will throw themselves at challenges. Socialites will interact with their fellow players in the world, and so on. People don't like to admit this because it doesn't feel like true role-playing, and some game masters even think players acting per their own motivations is immoral or incorrect. Those game masters are idiots. You run games for humans, and humans gonna human. Character abilities and resources. Every character has skills, abilities, talents, and resources that equip them for handling certain tasks or taking certain approaches. Players will make choices based on their character's strengths and weaknesses, and they absolutely should. That's human. Social dynamics. Role-playing games are cooperative, social games, and people are influenced, consciously and unconsciously, by the social situations they're in. This ain't just about teamwork, but teamwork is a part of it. It's about how social dynamics affect behavior. For example, it's important that I say for example because everybody will think this is the only factor I'm talking about, because I don't go into social dynamics in a lot of detail here. But anyway, for example, most players understand implicitly that the party has to stay a party. Parties can split up for a little while, but they can't break up and go their separate ways without breaking the game. So most players won't even consider actions that would permanently break the group up. Likewise, most players don't consider their teammates to be targets or competition. And so many players have blind spots here. They can't even see certain options, and I need to add a parenthetical here. Or certain threats. They can't even see certain options or certain threats because of the social dynamic. And that's good, it's part of the game. Of course, shared goals give teams something to rally around and work toward, and so, again, in-game goals are a hugely important part of tabletop role-playing games. And now a sidebar called problem players. Whether they know it or not, when choosing character actions, every player runs a complex calculation based on in-game goals, character personality, personal motivation, character abilities, and social dynamics. And the game works best when everyone's doing just that. At the very least, the players will act in reasonable, if not predictable, ways, and will have a mostly harmonious play experience. Almost all problem players can be understood in terms of these factors.
I wrote the word even when I meant either.
Either they're escalating one factor to an extreme beyond all others, or else they're ignoring something they shouldn't. Snazzy's player, as described in the Ask Angry June 2023 mailbag, missing a hyphen, wasn't considering their character as a person in the world, and they were ignoring the social dynamic as well and threatening the party's in-game goals. That player who thinks failure makes better stories than success, they're more concerned with their personal motivations than with playing with the other players and contributing to their goals. Imbalances can also lead to dissatisfaction. For example, a player who is constantly asked to put their personal motivations aside, either because the character they rolled doesn't support them, or because the group dynamic doesn't allow them to pursue their motivations, will end up miserable. And on the extreme end, lots of such imbalances can make players incompatible with each other. Meaningful choice and play style. In games, as in life, you can't always get what you want. At least you can't get everything you want. And when you can't, the choice you make reveals the person you are inside. An extreme example is the heroic choice to suffer loss, injury, or death rather than do something you consider morally wrong or ignore someone in harm's way. In that situation, you face a choice between living long and living right, so which do you choose? How each player balances those five forces in each and every situation, because every situation requires a unique calculus and universal rules don't work, defines or reflects their play style. It's what makes some players compatible with others, some players more likable than others, and some players a pain in the ass to run for. Remember this shit. It'll be important in September. Meanwhile, those choices are also the essence of role-playing. The single most expressive thing any player can do is to choose their character's next action. It's also, quite literally, the only thing in the player's control at the role-playing game table. It's the only place where the game tests the player, which you gotta have. You can't remove the balancing act every player must perform when choosing actions based on in-game goals, character personality, player motivation, character skill, and social dynamics without also removing the game itself. Without also removing the game from itself. And now a sidebar I call Why I Hate What I Hate. I'll let you in on a secret. Every player I hate is hidden somewhere in this article, okay? Put the words in, you will find the names of every player hidden, you know, in sequence in the words of this article. No. I'll let you in on a secret. Every player behavior I hate is on full display in this talk. If I've ever said, I hate when players do this, or doing this is playing wrong, you can probably find the reason somewhere in this screed. Long-ass, overly detailed backstories? I don't hate them because I don't want players to have visions of their characters, but because those visions are only one of the five factors to consider when choosing actions. A character's backstory is no more important than the character's abilities or the player's motivations when taking action, and it's arguably less important than the game's shared goal and social dynamics. The players who write those long-ass detailed backstories, who set them in stone, thereby elevate them above all else. They become rigid.
Such character visions must be malleable so they can bend when other factors demand it, or else it's the game that breaks. Can I roll to solve the puzzle or win the social encounter? No, you can't, because your character's abilities ain't the be-all and end-all of the game. You're erasing everything else from the choice equation, including the part where the game tests you, the player, to randomly determine an outcome. No. Can I just roll a die to pick what I do next? Get the hell out of my basement! And characters act. If you ain't making your players make deliberate choices, you're destroying the things that make role-playing games role-playing games. Without deliberate choices to reveal both the character and the player, there's no role-playing. And without testing the player, there's no game. So what the hell are you even doing at the table at that point? But you also can't take the character's statistics from the equation. Just because the player's smart enough to say the perfect thing at the perfect time, that doesn't mean they deserve the win. When choosing actions, players must consider their character's abilities as much as they consider anything else. If your character's a social moron with chronic foot-in-mouth disease, and you decide to deliver an inspiring and impassioned speech, you're taking a gamble. You're hoping your brilliant speech is enough to overcome your character's piss-poor charisma. It's a valid choice to make. It's like throwing yourself in the water to save a drowning kid, even though you can barely swim. But it ain't a sure thing. It can't be. Meaningful choice comes down to how you resolve conflicts. On the one hand, you want to give this brilliant speech a player motivation that you think can resolve the situation, helping the party toward their shared in-game goal. But on the other hand, your character sucks at this kind of thing. Your character lacks the abilities. The choice to take a chance on the die is a meaningful one. If the GM said, "Great speech, have a win," and if you knew your GM was the kind of GM to do that shit, your action wouldn't mean anything. It'd just be the optimal choice. Part of playing the game is considering what your character can and can't do. It's part of the test. That's why the game's rules always get a say. Players don't just get a win for declaring clever enough actions. They declare clever actions, and that cleverness is factored in when you, the game master, determine the outcome. Because you are the rules. When you decide whether an action can succeed and whether it can fail and whether it's worth rolling for, that is the game's rules having a say. And to do it right, you must weigh everything about every unique situation to make the right call. This is why I rail against online game masters making hypothetical calls about imaginary situations away from the table. That ain't how true game masters do it. Plus, as a side note, I was going to add this note in as a dig to certain people who know who they are, but I didn't, but I'm going to add it into the proofread aloud and let those of you who this is see themselves. Plus, it leads to the stupids when you're trying to talk about how you would resolve an action in game, like saying, well, okay, so if a player jumps over a pit, it's one thing, but what if a player uses a rope that is dangling over the pit to jump over the pit? Then do they get a bonus for using the rope? Oh my God, you're an idiot! Because here's the thing, nobody ever says, I will jump over the pit using the rope to help me. What they say is, I swing over the pit on the rope, and therefore the action you're adjudicating is the character swinging over the pit on a rope. It's not jumping over a pit with the help of a rope. The character is swinging, but you can't see it that way when you talk about it away from the game table, because the part you're missing is no player would ever say, I will jump over the pit swinging with the rope or using the rope to help me. I will use the rope for an assist. They will say, I'm gonna swing across the pit on the rope. And that's the action you're adjudicating, which is why I'm not answering any questions about any game system I might be developing that have to do with whether I would consider swinging on the rope a bonus to jumping over a pit. No, because you're not jumping over a pit, you're swinging over a pit. They're two completely different actions. Oh my God. Anyway, back to the article. When one of my players does the impassioned speech thing, I consider the character's charisma and social skills when asking myself, can this work and can it fail? A silver-tongued bard saying just the right thing to just the right person? That's so unlikely to fail it ain't worth rolling for. But the same speech coming from an idiot who can misspeak anything into an insult? He can fail whenever he opens his mouth. And for fuck's sake, don't even ask because I don't do any math or compare any numbers or anything like that. I just make a call. That's how true game masters do it. This is how it is. Everything I've said in True Game Mastery to this point derives from everything I've explained above about what games are and why people play them. You might not be able to see the logical progression from these words to every point, but it's there. And technically, I'm breaking the rules I set at the start of this series by justifying myself with this long-ass speech. But I need you to either get on board or get off the dock, because we're in for some rough waters ahead. If you can't accept the adage that players choose and characters act, and everything it entails, you can't run an NPC. Why? I'll tell you next time. And that is the Proofread Aloud.